UVic Military Oral History Interview with Mr. Jim Kempling, 19 November 2009. All right, so if we could just situate your experiences first with a quick overview of your military career.
Okay. I joined the Army in 1961, went to the Royal Military College, Royal Rhodes, graduated in 65, joined the Princess Patricias. Spent 3 years in Germany, came back from there, spent 2 years on staff at the Royal Military College, returned to my regiment, the Airborne Regiment, did 2 years with the Airborne Regiment, came back, went to Staff College, company commander in my unit in Victoria here, did a tour in Cyprus as a company commander, went to Staff College, did a couple of years doing a graduate degree here, back to the Airborne Regiment, commanded to commando. Promoted Lieutenant Colonel, Senior Staff Officer, Operations and Plans in Mobile Command Headquarters. Commanded my regiment in Calgary, took them to Cyprus for a six-month tour. Went to Australia for a couple of years on Staff College. Came back to Mobile Command Headquarters as Deputy Chief of Staff Reserves, and then took early retirement. During my time, my first tour in the Airborne Regiment, deployed to Montreal as part of the October 1970 response. So that's where I am.
Perfect. Now, just now you were talking about development of rules of engagement, and you said that they probably weren't necessary earlier because the engagements that Canada was involved in involved professional armies that could be trusted to follow the rules. And you were saying that Vietnam was probably when we started noticing that we needed more defined rules. So could you elaborate on that again?
It's not that rules of engagement weren't necessary. They were, but they were quite simple and straightforward, and there wasn't very much in the way of gray area. In the Cyprus situation, you had a uniformed army on both sides of the line who understood war in the way that NATO armies understood war, understood what the rules of armed conflict were, and you had a high degree of confidence that the only people that were going to shoot at you were people that were specifically ordered to do so. You knew, you could easily identify the parties, and we often sent people with just a blue beret on their head for protection and flying a blue flag in a white, you know, brightly colored white vehicle in between people with loaded weapons without any real degree of concern at all. There was risk, but there was a lot of clarity, so we had a few people shot, and there were a few people on both sides shot, but it was pretty clear and straightforward. During the Vietnam War, you suddenly have several major NATO forces, you know, including the Australians, who are in a situation where you can't identify the enemy. The enemy is mixed in with a civilian population that you are allegedly trying to help, and everything is pretty murky, and you end up with incidents like the massacre at My Lai. I attended an American Special Forces course in Fort Bragg after that incident took place, and the level of focus that the Americans were putting in training on the rules of engagement was massive. Everybody was expected to... the shift was the individual soldier was expected to make individual legal and moral judgments that were really quite complex. I'm going into a village, I'm taking fire from a hut, and there are women and children around. What do I do? When is it legitimate, and what is a sort of proportional response? And suddenly you're in a situation where you're expecting an individual soldier to make these kind of judgments, and you suddenly have to provide them a degree of training that is quite different than it was before, and at a much higher level of intensity. And we've learned some very tough lessons over the years on what's required to make that happen. You being a pilot, the same thing is true with care folks, and we've had some nasty incidents of friendly fire and so on the air side, and it used to be quite simple. You know, beyond this line, you can shoot anything that moves, and that's just not the case anymore. It's got to be very, very controlled.
So you're saying that the training has got much more complex. So in your training as an officer, what sort of training on rules of engagement or that type of regulation did you have, if any?
Well, I actually had quite a bit, and I was probably unusual. I did a graduate course at RMC on the law of armed conflict, so I had quite a bit of background on it. But if I think about the normal conventional training that everybody would have taken, there was training on, you know, what are the rules of the Geneva Convention, what are the rules of armed conflict, you don't blow up churches, you don't shoot prisoners, that sort of stuff that arose out of the experiences in Korea and the Second World War. There was also a good deal of training on aid of civil power operations, because we had an ongoing role during that period to be prepared to go into prisons if the guards went on strike or if there was a riot. We practiced fairly regularly responding to emergency situations in the civil community, and increasingly in the 70s, even before the incident in Quebec, there was increasing concern that military force might be needed to respond to that kind of stuff. And so there was a fair bit of training on that sort of scenario, but nothing at all on scenarios like we're currently involved in Afghanistan, because we hadn't been involved and we didn't see the potential for Canadian forces being involved at that period of time. Quebec was a bit of an eye-opener because suddenly we were deployed in pretty massive numbers in the middle of, you know, one of the biggest cities in Canada. Might have even been the biggest city at the time. In the midst of a downtown area, in direct contact with the civilian populace. So there were lawyers all over the place constantly talking about the issue and briefing soldiers on what the rules of engagement were. And just to illustrate, when Pierre Laporte was... What's it, Pierre Laporte? I may be getting the wrong guy. One of the hostages was killed. The body was recovered and there was a funeral. I think it was Pierre Laporte. There was concern relatively late in the game that the FLQ might use the occasion of the funeral to cause further difficulties and do some selective assassination. There seemed to be a continuum of violence that was in kind of revolutionary tactical manuals like Carlos Marlaguerilla, mini manual of the urban guerrilla. Sort of said you start off with demonstrations and then bombings and then selective assassination. And the perception was that we were at the selective assassination stage. And so the idea was that there could well be snipers positioned along the route of the funeral cortege to assassinate political figures. At very short notice, two Mandarin Airborne Regiment was deployed along the route on the rooftops. We had very poor communication with the soldiers. You would have one or two soldiers on each rooftop because that's how thin we were stretched. And the kind of instructions that were given to soldiers were, if you see somebody on a rooftop or in an upper story window who appears to have a rifle and they are not wearing a brown beret, shoot them. I mean, that was the way it was translated from the legalese. Is there a visible and imminent threat type of talk into soldier talk? if you think somebody's going to shoot somebody, you shoot them first. We had another incident where we were working with police forces, and there was a farmhouse, and it was a cordon and search operation, and the two commando had a cordon set up, and the police were coming into the building, and the expectation was that if there was any bad guys in there, they would be heading out towards the cordon. The difficulty, of course, is it was dark. A lot of the policemen weren't in uniform. And so you were going to have people with weapons coming towards this line of soldiers who were all lying down there with... And the instruction to the soldiers was, if you're going to shoot somebody, just make absolutely sure it isn't a cop. And our primary objective is to take people alive. So, again, behind this, there's a lot of lawyers sitting in back rooms, you know, thinking up a whole bunch of subordinate clauses, but at the end of the day, you've got to give instructions to a soldier who is lying on their belly in the rain and cold, you know, looking over his sights and deciding whether he's going to pull the trigger. So there's a heavy degree of reliance on soldiers don't panic, and they're well-disciplined. And if necessary, they're prepared to take a hit. And I think that remains, I think that remains true today. That one of the reasons we have been as successful as we have is because of that fact. And where it has broken down, like in Somalia, it's because there wasn't that degree of discipline. So
the adherence to those instructions is really a matter of soldier discipline and training in advance. You mentioned that there you had a lot of lawyers briefing soldiers on sort of their rules of engagement in the FLQ crisis.
Yeah.
Was that before or after you were there?
After.
After?
Yeah.
What if any, preparation did you have before that?
We had general training on crowd control, cordon and search operations, and that type of stuff in advance of it, because there had been some tension before that. At one time, we were on standby to fly into Vancouver to do crowd control in Stanley Park. But there hadn't been, there had been some lawyer involvement, but not kind of directly talking to the troops, not to the degree of intensity we saw when we got into Quebec. So I think when we got on the ground, there was a perception of we better make sure that everybody is up to snuff, and therefore we better have a little bit of direct lawyer-to-soldier contact. And it was, I mean, because we were talking with military lawyers, it was generally pretty good. But we were all sort of sitting in a hangar out at St. Hubert, and we did, you know, get the soldiers together, and they had a little session with them, and people had little rules of engagement cards and all kinds of things like that. But again, it worked primarily because the soldiers would do exactly what they were told to do. They were quite a well-disciplined crew.
You mentioned some incidents of perhaps things that could have gone wrong. Were there any incidences of hostility from the civilian populace or aggression?
Surprisingly not. I recall one circumstance where we went into downtown Montreal and we cordoned off an entire city block. And the rules were nobody gets in, nobody gets out. So you had armed soldiers with ball ammunition surrounding this block, and mom comes up saying, "My kid is in there. I just nipped out to the store to get breakfast." And to a large extent, you were saying to the, you know, a guy who's a platoon commander or a section commander, use your common sense. We're not here to cause a riot. You obviously can't afford to escort everybody back in, but if it looks like mom and she's got a kid in her arms, and, you know, use your common sense. And so some of the people were allowed through. And the crowds were, I think generally speaking, the people in Montreal were very, very alarmingly, maybe not supportive of the level of military intervention. They welcomed it. I think they were, there was a high level of concern about what was going on. And for the most part, the population was very supportive. So they would engage the soldiers in, you know, gee, we're glad to see you here, can I get you a cup of coffee type of stuff, rather than any real adverse reaction to it.
So were there any instances where soldiers weren't really sure what to do and had to ask for clarification, or did everyone pretty much know and use their common sense, as you said?
We had some issues, but it was primarily the interaction with police forces. You had both the RCMP, three forces, the RCMP, the provincial police of Sûreté de Quebec, and the Montreal Municipal Police Force, and they didn't trust each other, particularly the Montreal City Police Force were not particularly trusted by the RCMP and the Sûreté de Quebec. So there were some conflicts as those three groups tried to work together, but not so much with the military. We went on lots of operations with them where people had to use some judgment when they got on the ground. I can, rather amusingly, they thought that Cross might be held in a place called Albert's Pet Shop, which sounds bizarre. But we went and surrounded this bloody pet shop, and the police used what they could describe as a universal key to get in, which is a battering ram with screaming dogs and cats and monkeys and everything else, of course, when all this noise went off. But nothing really, I mean, it went surprisingly well, but I think largely because A, the general population was very supportive, and B, the soldiers were very well trained. And in that circumstance, there's kind of an inverse relationship between the amount of force you deploy and the amount of violence you have to exercise. If I send 10 people in to control a crowd of 1,000 people, the only real way they're, if the crowd gets unruly, they're going to be able to control them is with live ammunition. If I send 500 soldiers in the same circumstance, all I have to do is stand there. So
would you say that the October crisis itself, would you consider it comparable to foreign soil peacekeeping around the time?
No. Well, around the time, yes, in that the law was very clear. There weren't a lot of gray areas. You know, you were subject to Canadian law. The constraints of that were very clear. It's the kind of role that police exercise all the time, and it was simply a matter of explaining to soldiers and making clear to soldiers what those conditions were, and their general experience with police would give them a broad understanding of that anyway, so it wasn't like you were trying to teach them a foreign language or anything. And that is quite different now, and the transition point for Canada was Somalia. And there was a gross failure in leadership. Because you had, I think the senior leadership on the ground didn't exercise effectively their duty to make sure that the rules of engagement were workable. You have sort of the general authority to protect your own installations if somebody is coming to them. And that's fair enough if you've got people actually trying to attack you. But in Somalia, what you have is a bunch of people who are poor and hungry and starving, and they want to come in and steal whatever you've got. And some of it is, I'm trying to steal food or fuel or whatever. And some of it is, I'd like to steal ammunition and explosives to do nasty things. And you can't distinguish between the two. And so the kind of instructions that the troops got were, you can't shoot at any of these people. But we want you to discourage them from coming back. And most soldiers, most of the time, can probably understand that and handle it. But if you get a few people in an organization that aren't very well disciplined and are a little bit over the top, you end up with the kind of violence that occurred. Soldiers thinking, okay, I'm going to teach this guy a lesson. He's going to go back and tell his buddy the last thing on earth you want to have happen to you is to get captured by the airborne regiment because they're going to beat the snot out of you. And they went overboard and killed him. And that was a direct result of the fact that the soldiers, A, lacked some discipline at the bottom end, but more importantly, they didn't get clear workable rules of engagement from the top side.
The mission was changed almost, I can't remember exactly how close, but very close to deployment date from a standard UN peacekeeping mission to, I think Section 7?
Yeah.
Peacekeeping mission, which changed up the rules of engagement to something much more hard. I think it was a U.S. directive that did that. Do you think that would have contributed to the confusion in the rules of engagement?
It would have, but if the guy who was commanding two commanders was an idiot. I knew him as a young officer. He was the kind of guy who would do a parachute jump in his mess kit. Was well known. He should never have been given command of the unit to start with. We had in the Airborne Regiment a long tradition of selecting senior NCOs and officers who were the very best that the regiments could provide. And that changed in the years just before deployment to Afghanistan. They downgraded the status of the unit, and it became much less attractive to go into a command position, and they ended up with some people like Tony Seward commanding, who I wouldn't have given command of a section to, ended up in command of a unit made up of very hardcore, very tough, very aggressive soldiers that need to have very strong leadership. And they just didn't get it. And I think that was amplified up the chain. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination they were all incompetent, but somebody should have stepped in and said, this unit is not ready to deploy to Afghanistan. And I think the problem was that the unit had a very, very good reputation in the years before that, and there wasn't a recognition that things had gone quite seriously downhill. I would have quite happily taken the soldiers that I commanded in 2 Commando into Afghanistan, and I would have been absolutely confident that that kind of thing never would have happened, irrespective of what anybody had told me. Because at every level of command, it's your responsibility to make sure that your soldiers are doing the right thing. And that broke down in a pretty serious way. So I think as a result of that, now when people are going to Afghanistan, and I've talked to a lot of folks that have been over and have trained soldiers to go over, and the type of training that's going on is really of a very, very high quality. The type of exercises they do in Wainwright are outstanding. And they get people that look like Afghanis and speak like Afghanis, and the level of assimilation is pretty good to deal with exactly the kind of issue we're talking about.
Do you think that strong, very clear rules of engagement could have helped to counteract the weak leadership, or was that sort of a hand-in-hand?
I think it's a hand-in-hand thing. I don't think a bunch of people sitting in the back room writing complex legal arguments. Are ever going to be able to successfully penetrate down to the soldier level if you lack strong leadership. Company commanders, platoon commanders, senior NCOs need to really understand stuff so that the instructions to soldiers are delivered in clear soldierly terms and not in terms that, you know, takes a degree in law to understand. Because really, at the end of the day, it's most of it is applying reasonable standards of ethics and common sense, and that's what you want to have happen. I think at the end of the day, though, the presumption that an individual soldier is going to be able to make complex legal and ethical decisions in the heat of a very difficult situation is just not going to happen. And that means you've got to have that they will do what their leaders tell them to do in an emergency. I remember having a rather heated debate when I was with the American Special Forces, and they were talking about melee and talking about the importance of individual soldiers making these. No, sir, I'm not going to fire, you know, when I go into that village. And I said to them, look, if I went into a village and I told my soldiers to shoot everything in sight, that's exactly what they would do. Because I've trained them to do that. And the presumption that they're going to make individual ethical judgments that override my clear direction to them is nonsense. They won't. And ultimately, at some point, as you get down the chain of command, it may not be a valid legal defense to say I was only following orders, but that's exactly what's going to happen. You just don't have time to do that kind of thing. You know, if you're flying an F-18 at a gazillion miles an hour and you have 3 nanoseconds to make a decision, not much time for ethical and moral and legal debate at that point.
So do you think that perhaps rules of engagement and these sort of legal breakdowns are more for leadership positions than they are for the individual soldier?
I think the individual soldiers need to understand them, and I think the training of the individual soldier is important, but it's the same as an individual soldier needs to know what the bigger plan is so that if they have to make individual judgments, they can do it within a broader context. And a lot of times, you put quite junior soldiers in situations where you expect them to make individual judgments. In Afghanistan, you have an observation out commanded by a master corporal, and you're going to expect them to make those kind of judgments on the ground in a difficult situation. So they do have to understand it. But when they are acting as part of a larger force, the only expectation you should have of them is that they're going to do exactly as they're told. So they need to understand it. But you don't want to operate under the presumption that Corporal Bloggins in the heat of battle is going to say, no, sir, I've considered the moral and the legal issues concerning this particular thing, and I'm not going to pull my trigger. I think that's unrealistic. I think some lawyers might think it's perfectly realistic, but it's just not. And part of the difficulty is when it starts to get into court, the people that end up being scapegoats are the guys on the ground. And Somalia is a classic example where the soldiers did some really nasty stuff, but the really severe elements of discipline stopped right there. Nobody threw Tony Seward in jail, and they should have. And I know a great number of people who have served in the Airborne Regiment who would quite happily have seen Tony Seward in jail and cheered if that's what had happened. Instead, what we saw the period of the inquiry was the, you know, the chief of defense staff being mealy mouth and weasel words and all kinds of things like that, doing the dance. And there were a few people that stood up and said the right thing, the appropriate thing, but not a lot. It wasn't one of our finest hours.
I've read, you're talking about Tony Seward, and I've read that the rules of engagement were reinterpreted by leaders at that level on the ground and before they're passed down to the lower ranks, sort of reinterpreting the legalese and making it comprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you find that that's sort of appropriate, that the leaders interpret it and put their own spin on the rules of engagement, and is there training on how to do that properly?
I think there probably is now, and you go through scenarios. How would these legal terms play out in this particular scenario? I think that in that particular case, that the interpretation just was not very good, and there wasn't enough on the ground supervision. It was sort of, I'm going to give you an instruction, and then I'm going to go like this. And not really watch what's going on.
Do you think that was deliberate or a mistake? Is it common for those sort of orders to be given and then expected to be obeyed without that kind of supervision, or is it more common for really more close supervision to occur?
I think good officers, when they give orders that are open to interpretation, have to be prepared to stand up and take the hit if they go sideways. And failure to exercise appropriate supervision is not, you know, not an acceptable defense. And in the case of Tony Seward, he gave flaky instructions and didn't follow up. So he failed on two accounts.
All right. So let's just talk briefly about Cyprus.
Okay.
This is sort of the earlier forms of peacekeeping,
yeah,
with the armies that were professional and familiar with NATO-style rules of engagement,
yeah,
or not necessarily rules of engagement, but rules of warfare. What was your impression on the ground when you arrived for the first time?
Well, the handover process was very, very thorough. So you would go in and you had a reconnaissance party that went out in advance, and even down at the individual soldier level, each observation post that was taken over, there were written instructions, and people had to be able to, an individual soldier had to be able to stand up and give a briefing, saying, here's what my rules of engagement are, here's where I can identify the people that are on both sides of the line, I know the individual commanders by name. That's where their bunker is. There's a machine gun over there. There's, so they knew it in very great detail, and were expected to be able to brief anybody at any time on what the situation was, and it was exercised with monotonous regularity. In fact, it was partly to relieve the monotony. You're sitting in the heat and all by yourself, and so people would go around on tours of the line. When they come up to an LP, the soldier would come out and say, would you like a briefing, sir? And you'd say, yeah, and they would go through their spiel. There were some situations that were difficult. Periodically, the Greeks would decide to have a little demonstration near the line. We need to recover our homeland type stuff. And they would put women and children and everything like that in these crowds. But there was never really a concern that these were serious, because all you had to do at the end of the day was step out of the way and say, if you really want to go and try and crawl over those Turkish trenches, fill your boots. And you knew that they knew where the line was and they weren't going to go past it. You had some situations involving smuggling and that type of thing going on that would periodically lead to shots being fired across the line. Or we had one incident where it was middle of the night, it was alleged that some Turkish soldiers had come down, stopped a Greek car, captured a Greek woman, and carried her off into the hills. What really had happened is they had come down, stolen some cigarettes. But that was a story. So in the middle of the night, you have the Greek forces ready to go to war to save the virtue of this, you know, Helen of Troy recreated, and the Turks doing the same thing. And in the middle is a Canadian sergeant and a section. And so the Canadian sergeant, using his best common sense, puts a UN flag on his aerial on his radio, puts a big flashlight so everybody can see that it's there, walks up right into the Turkish lines when all these guys are out like this, and berates the Turkish commander and says, "You get your soldiers," you know, just really lays down the law. And this is a soldier talking to a colonel, a sergeant talking to a colonel, then goes back and does exactly the same thing on the other side of the line and puts the Greeks back to bed and sorts it out. So there was an expectation. I mean, this guy went above and beyond, but there was that kind of expectation that people could behave with that degree of confidence and get away with it. We had another situation where one of my patrols had gone in an area that Turks didn't think they should go in, and so they captured a Canadian. I wasn't really concerned that the soldier was going to be mistreated. In fact, he was taken back and fed Turkish beer and all kinds of things. He was treated quite well. But they were trying to make a point. And we deployed a whole bunch of armored vehicles out with weapons aboard them and everything like that. And then I took my Jeep out in the middle and we laid a tablecloth over the top and put a couple of wine glasses out and a bottle of wine. And I put a chair out and another chair out and just sat there until the Turkish commander came out. And we sat down and had a glass of wine and talked about it. And you could get away with doing that kind of, you know, rather theatrical sort of thing, because you knew that at the end of the day, the guy on the other side of the line's career was on the line over this sort of thing. And he really didn't want this to be an incident that got reported in UN headquarters. Anyone knew it. So you could.
Sure.
And I knew the Turkish commander because I talked to him on a fairly regular basis and had a high degree of confidence he wasn't going to shoot me.
So you felt pretty much with regards to Cyprus, you felt that your rules were clear enough, your soldiers well trained enough and disciplined enough,
yeah,
that everything would go smoothly as it did.
Yeah. And we actually briefed the other side on what our rules of engagement were. And we showed them our weapons and demonstrated our weapons and, you know, did firing exercises on their ranges so that they were very familiar with. And the intent was to demonstrate to them that if push came to shove, our soldiers knew what they were doing and would do it. So when the Turks actually invaded Cyprus, most of the UN just bailed out, and the Canadians, it was the Airborne Regiment actually, were in the airport at Nicosia, and they just said to the Turkish army, "No, we're not leaving. You're not coming any further. This is as far as it goes. You're NATO. We're NATO. You're not coming up here, and if you do, we're going to shoot." And there was a British anti-aircraft battery or something like that with them. And the Turkish army stopped because they knew that, unlike, you know, the Swedes and the Danes and so on like that, who were largely school teachers and things, Canadians weren't. And when they said stop, that's what they meant. So there was that kind of professional respect between the forces, which doesn't exist in Afghanistan.
Slightly different situation there, I think.
Yeah.
Which is the more sort of confused situation that you're talking about, being,
yeah,
really the cause of the rise of the more complex ROE.
Yeah.
So, you left the military in 1988, is that correct?
Yeah.
During the years before your departure, did you notice, obviously you did notice the rules of engagement increasing. Did you experience any of that? Did you have to deal with any more complex ROE?
I was responsible for operations and plans at the Mobile Command Headquarters. So we were writing more complex rules of engagement as part of our operational planning process. We were starting to contemplate that even before things like Somalia came along.
What was your opinion on that at the time, on the, how things were getting more complex?
Well, the observing the Vietnam experience, and Canada had a unique window on observing the Vietnam experience because we did so much training with the Americans. I think there was a high level of sensitivity that there was a major issue here that, that needed to be dealt with, and it was something that before that point our training hadn't, our training just hadn't dealt with at all. And so we were doing things like very, very aggressive conduct after capture training that was largely as a result of the Vietnam experience. So when we would have exercises and run our own prisoner of war camps, and we did that in two ways. One, to train soldiers how prisoners should be treated and handled. But the second element of it was to train our own soldiers what they could likely expect if they were captured by people who weren't so constrained. So we did some very nasty things to our soldiers. The waterboarding thing, that is the... I was waterboarded on an exercise. You know, you kind of stripped down in the late fall, hog-tied, sprayed with water so that your body temperature has gone way down, waterboarded to the point of unconsciousness. Probably overboard, but that was the kind of stuff that was happening in response to, we've got a very different sort of military situation that we're going to have to face in the future. The level of training involved things like doing live fire training, where suddenly people would be going through a live fire range and they would have targets that were obviously military targets, and then there would be a target that would appear. It would be a little grass hut with a woman and children in it. The soldiers wouldn't know that in advance. They would just be going through it, and suddenly you come across this, and what do the soldiers do? And sometimes they would, you know, blow the thing apart, and you would have a little debrief afterwards that you can't always make the bold assumption that there are bad guys in there.
Do you think that was effective training?
It was to an extent. It's not nearly as good as what is done now, and it was largely done at the initiative of people on the ground rather than, you know, high level directives from above. It was just people would come back from other exercises and say, we got to start doing some of this kind of stuff, and would on their own initiative put it in.
So looking back on your experiences as an officer, do you figure that ROEs currently are a useful and like a beneficial tool for soldiers on the ground, like overall positive?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're an essential framework, but it has to be combined with really, really good training and really good discipline, really good supervision. And without those things, it doesn't matter how good the rules of engagement are. You wouldn't get a satisfactory result. You will either get sort of what we experienced with less professional organizations like the Swedes, who you know, tend to send people who are model school teachers and you know, they're reservists with a degree of military training, but not really good, solid military training. And they'll just bail out. They won't do the job that has to be done. Or the flip side is the overreaction, the inappropriate use of force. And rules of engagement alone aren't going to bridge that gap.
Do you have any further comments or insights you'd like to close with?
No, I'm good.
All right. Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Good luck on the paper.